Thank you, Ramesh, for inviting me to do this. And thank you, Wendell, for being such a good colleague all these years. If I have time at the end, I'll tell you how I met Wendell. I was at these meetings. I will tell you that the first thing I had to do before I met Wendell Gillum was to find out how to pronounce his last name. From Ralph Leonard, who was my first boss with ARS, who was a PhD student who he claimed showed you around the NC State campus when you came there. And you stayed a long time, so Ralph must have done a good job. So when Ramesh asked me to do this, I decided that I would sort of combine something I needed to do, which was come up with some ideas for how to respond to questions I was getting about why the buffers that are being installed now may not be showing the effectiveness of the buffers that we've studied. And so I thought there might be some new insights from these old buffer studies and would help me answer some of these questions. So this is what I decided to do is, excuse me, to give you an overview of some of these questions that are coming up now from the management community to the scientists. Then look at these early studies in North Carolina, Maryland, and Georgia, and revisit them and see what they might tell us about answers to these questions, and just see if they can inform the current discussion. One of the reasons that we're interested in doing this, of course, is that we're putting in all sorts of buffers. This is just CRP buffers, just buffers that were done under the Conservation Reserve Program through 2005. You can see the scale is up to the 50,000 hectare range, and so you can see they're being done widely around the country. Actually, a lot are being done in North Carolina, and certainly this is, and I think Deanna's going to talk about this towards the end, this is due to the work that Wendell has led in North Carolina. North Carolina is one of the leaders, but it's being done all over the country, and it's very important to figure out what sort of benefits we're getting from them. So this is how I've phrased these questions that I've been getting, and a number of us have been getting from the managers and the practitioners around the country, and that is, what's the retention efficiency of mature buffers, the kinds that are going out in the field? What's the time needed to establish these functions? And one of the most interesting ones that I felt we were getting was, our data from experimental buffers appropriate to describe the real-world buffers? And that's the one that really got me started thinking about what we had done in the research so far. So I think one of the key things that we need to look at, and I think the early studies that were done are going to be shown to be very useful for this, is what is the condition of the soil and vegetation in the buffer at the time of the study? How long had the area been in a buffer? What was done, if anything, in terms of management to regenerate the vegetation? And what was done, if anything, to modify the drainage? So most of us have, when we've looked at buffers, we've tended to look at a subset of these inputs and outputs. I don't know that anyone's ever looked at all of these, because frankly it's just beyond the scope of most of our studies to really be able to look at all of those. But this gives you an idea of the things that we've looked at. The early studies really focused on this local groundwater movement. As Wayne was saying, one of the reasons for this is because of the understanding that had been gained from the controlled drainage studies, and understanding that if this water wasn't going through the drains, there's a really good chance that it was going through buffers if these buffers existed. Certainly, looking at surface runoff became important in some of these studies. I think we've done a pretty good job on the shallow subsurface flow and the surface runoff. I don't think we've done nearly as good a job on the flooding interactions and how that works in buffers, and certainly some of the things that we've done have tended to neglect the regional groundwater flows. So we'll focus most of the studies that this group of researchers have done, who have been approaching this from the standpoint of how do these relate to agricultural practices, have tended to focus on surface runoff and subsurface flow. Some of the things that we know from these studies are shown here. All of the graphs at the bottom from these early studies, actually there's a few that aren't quite so early, but they're thrown in there on the bottom, show that we get a lot of reduction of nitrate coming from the edge of a field over at the left-hand side of the graph. going into a riparian forest, all of those are through a riparian forest buffer from field. The one at the top shows a system that doesn't have much reduction, and that's because of high flow rates and really essentially no wetland soils in that system. The concentrations in surface runoff are not as widely studied, but this is some of the kind of information we have from these studies. These are, you can see that one of these is from 1984, and some are more recent. So that's the general kind of thing we get. Now, looking back at these earlier studies, what I tried to do is go back and sort of and answer some of these questions by going through the early work. And so I started at the beginning, and that would be the beginning for Wendell's work, was the work that he did with a graduate student, Jacobs. What was Jacobs' first name?
Tony
Jacobs, okay. And this came out in 1983 and was published later on in 1985. And my meeting with Wendell actually had to do with something that was in the JEQ paper, and if I have time, I'll tell you about that. But what they found was that in these watersheds that were in the range of 25% to 50% agriculture with naturally occurring riparian buffers along streams, they found that a lot more nitrogen left the streams, left the fields than entered the streams. And I think this sounds like Wendell, maybe it was Tony, but unintentionally, but fortunately, the nitrogen removal mechanism has been left largely intact where it is most needed. And that was a very important finding, because what they found was that these strips were able, these buffer strips, the naturally occurring forest buffers, were able to remove a lot of nitrate. And it was a floodplain landscape, it was heavily vegetated and poorly drained soil. So this is one of the keys, because if you're expecting a buffer that's not poorly drained and not heavily vegetated to give you this same sort of effectiveness, you're probably going to be disappointed. Next, they worked on Cypress Creek watershed in the Middle Coastal Plain. Some of this was published in what was actually the second in a pioneering series published by Dave Carell on watershed research. And the second one of these, which was published in 1986, really focused on the role of riparian zones in watersheds. And I think one of the things that's important here is that they recognized that the dense vegetation was very important. And they pointed out, and I went back and tried to find out what was known about the vegetation from these sites, but they pointed out that where the trees had been selectively cut, there was more understory and more forest floor vegetation. So one thing we know about these areas, and we'll find that out from some of the later studies, one thing we know about these areas is that they weren't left alone by farmers. The trees were cut. They were cut, sometimes they were clear cut, sometimes they were selectively cut, but there was generally constant revegetation going on in these areas. So here are those questions again, and I'm going to show you these a number of times to sort of get back to these questions that we're getting from the managers. And the retention efficiency for groundwater nitrate in these areas of poorly drained soils and dense vegetation is high. And those are the two important things, poorly drained soils and dense vegetation. And it's important that to understand that these are real world buffers. So when we're asked questions about, well, why would we think that real world buffers would do the same things as your experimental buffers, I was puzzled, because all we've really managed to study in many of these cases were real world buffers. The forests were selectively harvested, and they were probably harvested repeatedly. The age is not known, but my guess is that we're, just from seeing some of these in the field, that we're looking at 30 to 40 year average tree age. They may or may not have been former agricultural soils. My guess is that they weren't. And that's important, because where we're putting buffers now is, of course, on former agricultural soils. In most cases, these probably weren't. The most effective buffers that have been studied are wetland soils They were the most effective ones. And on a watershed scale, they're going to be most effective, as you would expect, when a large proportion of the watershed was in buffers and not in cropland. So at the same time, and I don't know that Wendell really knew Dave Correll at the time, at the same time, there's another story that goes with that, at the same time, Dave Correll and a student, Bill Peterjohn, were working on buffers in Maryland. And they studied existing riparian forest buffers on the Road River watershed. And everything I'm going to show you now is from a presentation that I have from Dave Correll. This is the kind of system they were looking at, and of course it's exaggerated. This is a pretty, or not exaggerated, the scales are not the same. This is a pretty typical middle coastal plain system where you might have 15 to 20 feet of relief from the cornfield down to the stream in a linear distance of, say, 40 to 50 meters. And this is the kind of system that they were studying, and many of the middle coastal plain systems that Wendell and his group studied were very similar. The nitrate scale there is in micrograms per liter, so don't get too scared about that. But we're looking at, you know, going from around 8 milligrams per liter, and as you go down this hill slope, it doesn't necessarily, switch back and forth here, doesn't go down that much until you get down to the poorly drained area at the bottom of the hill. This is what their landscape looked like, and still does, pretty much. And this is actually Bill Peterjohn out in one of those forests. And I went back and tried to find out what they knew about their forests as well, and actually emailed Peterjohn and never heard from him, so I know he's at University of West Virginia because I checked with a friend of mine. But one of the things that was interesting in looking back and really looking carefully at the ecology paper by Peterjohn and Correll was that 72% of the sample trees in the riparian forest were less than 22 centimeters DBH. So, I mean, not huge trees. I mean, they actually had some huge, impressive trees, but we're looking at mostly, you know, trees that were still rapidly growing and relatively young forests that you would assume would be rapidly growing still, or at least growing some, as opposed to a big tree which is sort of maintaining itself. So once again, here are our questions. And the retention efficiencies in their existing riparian forest buffers were high. The nitrate removal was not on that better drained part of the hill slope, but was mainly in the poorly drained areas. These functions occurred in forests that were relatively young trees, based on knowing that 70% were less than 22 centimeters in diameter at breast height. And once again, real-world buffers, naturally occurring, very little, if anything, was ever done to help those forests along. And the most effective forests were on riparian forest buffers were on the poorly drained sites. Now, about the same time, we were doing studies in the coastal plain of Georgia, and the left is just a concept, sort of a cartoonish diagram of what we were doing on a watershed, looking at buffers at different places in that watershed. And we actually originally put in the buffer studies so that we sampled different kinds of crops. For some reason, we didn't realize how stupid that would be because the crops would be changed the next year. But luckily, we got a pretty good sampling of the riparian forest within the watershed. What we found in a nutshell is that you have a lot of nitrate coming in, very little going out. Ammonium is pretty much the same way, but essentially you're getting the conversion of an inorganic nitrogen input to a smaller but very much enhanced organic nitrogen output. The characteristics of these riparian forest buffers is they're on poorly drained to very poorly drained soils in general. But they also have some moderately well-drained soils at the edges, and this can be important because at the same time, a graduate student named Phillips was working on some of this stuff at East Carolina University. And what Phillips came up with was this model, which is actually, I don't think it was ever really carried forward too much, but it was very interesting because he had the idea that forget really how he got to this point, but what he basically came up with was that if you were dealing with a surface runoff dominated system that you wanted a deeper sandy soil, a deeper soil with higher infiltration rates to deal with the surface runoff. If you were working with a subsurface dominated system, you wanted a soil that was more poorly drained and that the water would move through more slowly. And what we have in a lot of the coastal plain, at least, and what would be an ideal buffer, is to have an infiltration zone at the beginning of it and a denitrification and retention zone as you move towards the stream. And that's actually what we found in these areas. The approximate width of these areas was about 40 meters. Mixed pine and hardwood vegetation, just very typical for the North Carolina and Georgia buffers, and very little drainage enhancement. We don't know if these were ever cropland or pasture. We think some were, but certainly not intensively managed in cropland. And all the forests, as far as we know, were naturally regenerated. And we actually had a graduate student who was did a very good job on doing a detailed study of these forests. And what's interesting when you look back at this is the average age of these forest stands was 22 to 35 years. And so we're not talking about old forests. Well, so you think, well, CRP is a 15-year contract in many cases. So you might not get to the function of these forests in a 15-year CRP contract, but certainly in a 20-year or 30-year contract, you certainly could. The average basal area of trees in these forests range from 20 to 54 square meters per hectare. And that doesn't mean much to me. It probably doesn't mean much to you. But it's going to be important to sort of keep that number in mind, 20 to 54 square meters per hectare of basal area. That is at breast height, the area of the tree, of the volume of the trees, the area of the trees. So that gave us the idea of this three-zone buffer system, and that's another story. The NRCS wanted to know what to do with the three-zone buffer system, and I think for a buffer system, I think they went to North Carolina and talked to Wendell and didn't tell them they were coming to Georgia to talk to us, and then on the way back they went to Maryland and talked to Dave Carell, and I think they got the same sort of information from everybody. And they went back and they came up with this kind of generalized buffer system. And this is with some modifications, partly due to bureaucracy, partly due to a better understanding of the systems, this is sort of what's being applied now. So the next thing that we did, and I think this is going to be sort of not the old buffer studies, but the middle-aged buffer studies. The next thing that we did is look at restoration into a three-zone buffer system. And this is just an aerial photograph showing you what we did. This was a riparian forest buffer below a liquid manure application area with a zone 3 of grasses, a zone 2 of pine trees, and a zone 1 of hardwoods. This is just planting it in 1991 and what it looked like in 2003, and I was out there this year doing some work in it and totally forgot to take my camera, so unfortunately I don't have a 2007 picture. The zone 1 was comprised of three hardwoods that are very typical in riparian areas, and zone 2 was comprised of improved slash. Now, I underlined improved because nothing has ever been done to try and get a better tree into a riparian forest buffer. This is 11 years after planting the tree buffer. Now, one of the things that we did in this buffer was to study denitrification pretty intensively using the acetylene inhibition technique. And what we found is that in this area, which was a wet pasture, which had had very little soil modification except to remove the woody vegetation in earlier years, about 10 years earlier, converted into a wet pasture for 10 years. And what we found in this system is that very early on, we got a lot of denitrification going on. And these are kilograms per hectare per day, some really high denitrification rates in this system. And so you can't really say, I mean, we planted the trees in February of 1991, started applying liquid manure in June of 1991, and fairly early on, we were getting these really high denitrification rates. You can't say that those are due to the forest buffer enhancing the denitrification. That was, if we hadn't had trees there, we'd have gotten these same denitrification rates. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We ended up with a 10-year study where we did budgets to look at percent retention. We have about 60%, 59% total nitrogen percent retention, and a little bit better on phosphorus retention. But some new information, and some of you are probably saying, boy, I've seen that a lot. Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of new information today, and that is that our basal area on these trees that have just gone through their 16th growing season is about the same as those 22 to 35 year old forests. So we've got a forest now that has accumulated not the same biomass, but certainly in basal area. They're not quite as tall, but in terms of basal area, we have about the same basal area of those areas that we were studying as mature forests in 16 growing seasons. So getting around to our management questions again. Associated with wetland soils, these retention efficiencies for nitrate should almost always be in the 60 to 80% range. And I can't see any reason to doubt that. With non-wetland soils and higher groundwater flow rates, for instance, the Correll 1994 study, the retention rates will be lower. Agricultural buffers with this subsidy, now we were dealing with both a water and nutrient subsidized system in that study I just showed you, but they can reach 100% of the basal area of what we say is a mature forest in 15 to 20 years, and the use of the basal area of the pine trees was greater than the basal area of the hardwoods. Use of these improved tree cultivars seems to speed the establishment. The nature of forest buffers makes studying an experimental buffer very difficult. So most of the studies have been done on what are clearly real-world buffers. So I don't think we have a real problem there. The experimental buffers, and they haven't always been this way, but experimental buffers have to be large enough to take in the complexities of the flow regimes for both surface and subsurface runoff. I don't know that we've always been able to do that. We haven't done a good job of trying to figure out what's coming up in regional groundwater, if anything, but one of the reasons that we've gone to real world buffers is experimental buffers would be so hard to get set up. And it's clear from the study that we did on the restoration that the denitrification can be very high early in the evolution of the system. How much time do I have left? 3 minutes. Okay, good. Well, this is I thought I would just leave this up there. These are two of my favorite pictures. One of them was taken by my major professor, Bob Todd, hanging out of an airplane. And the interest, you know, Wendell knew Bob back then. And I didn't know that you and Bob had this in common, though, Wendell. He was in the emergency room once. He almost cut his head off with a chainsaw. So they wouldn't have been able to reattach that. But I'm glad you got your thumb reattached. That's something I definitely didn't know about you. The one on the bottom is the best picture I've ever gotten of surface runoff coming through a riparian zone and spreading out into all sorts of little fingers running among the hummocks of litter going towards a stream. Well, like I said, I first met Wendell at this meeting. I think it was 85. And I had something to ask him about the Jacobs and Gillen paper. There was something there I didn't agree with. I don't remember what it was now. But the first thing I did was check with Ralph Leonard about what kind of guy Wendell was. He said, oh, yeah, go ask, you can ask him anything. Go ask him anything. I didn't know if Ralph was setting me up or not. But I said, well, so Dr. Gilliam's a nice guy. He said, yeah, he is, but he doesn't like to be called Gilliam. It's Gillen. And so I said, oh, okay. So I went up to Wendell, I cornered him at a poster, and I asked him the question, and he said, I don't remember how we did that. I'll have to check with, what was your technician's name, Bertha? Yeah. I'll have to check with Bertha on that. And I said, well, Dr. Gillen already did. And she said so-and-so, and he looked down at me and said, you already called her? I said, yeah, but if you want to check with her too, that'd be fine. I don't remember what it was. It was something in the paper I didn't agree with at the time, and today I probably would never go to that length. But I was so amazed that Wendell's response was, "Well, yeah, we need to check on that, and if we did it that way, we'll have to. I'll let you know." And that was the beginning of our friendship, and it started out as me. I guess I've been out of graduate school about 3 years, coming up to a perfect stranger and saying, "I think there's something wrong with your paper." So Wendell, it's been great being a colleague through the years, and you've gotten me involved in some pretty fun things, and I've gotten you involved in some things that I hope were a little bit fun, and it's been great working with you, and thank you for being such a great colleague.